I guess losing someone the way he lost Marlene can do that to a person, though that's not what it did to me. There are no slings on the roof for the zip line, and that's not why we came. I don't know why the others did, but I wanted to be up high. I wanted to see as far as I could. But all the land west of where I am is black, like it's draped in a dark blanket. For a moment, I think I can make out a glimmer of light on the horizon, but the next it's gone. Just a trick of the eyes. The others are quiet, too. I wonder if we're all thinking the same thing.
What do you think's out there?
Uriah finally says.
Zeke just shrugs, but Christina ventures a guess.
What if it's just more of the same?
Just more crumbling city, more factions, more of everything.
Can't be, Uriah says, shaking his head. There has to be something else.
Or there's nothing,
Zeke suggests.
Those people who put us all in here, they could just be dead. Everything could be empty.
I shiver. I had never thought of that before. But he's right. We don't know what's happened out there since they put us in here, or how many generations have lived and died since they did. We could be the last people left.
It doesn't matter, I say, more sternly than I mean to. It doesn't matter what's out there. We have to see it for ourselves, and then we'll deal with it once we have.
We stand there for a long time. I follow the bumpy edges of buildings with my eyes until all the lit windows smear into a line. Then Uriah asks Christina about the riot, and our still, silent moment passes as if carried away by the wind. The next day, Evelyn stands among the pieces of Janine Matthews' portrait in the erudite headquarters lobby and announces a new set of rules. Former faction members and factionless alike are gathered in the space and spilling out into the street to hear what our new leader has to say. And factionless soldiers line the walls, their fingers poised over the triggers of their guns, keeping us under control.
Yesterday's events made it clear that we are no longer able to trust each other, she says.
She looks ashen and exhausted.
We will be introducing more structure into everyone's lives until our situation is more stable. The first of these measures is a curfew. Everyone is required to return to their assigned living spaces at 9 o'clock at night. They will not leave those spaces until 8 o'clock the next morning. Guards will be patrolling the streets at all hours to keep us safe.
I snort and try to cover it up with a cough. Christina elbows me in the side and touches her finger to her lips. I don't know why she cares. It's not like Evelyn can hear me from all the way at the front of the room.
Tori, former leader of Dauntless, ousted by Evelyn herself, stands a few feet away from me, her arms crossed. Her mouth twitches into a sneer.
It's also time to prepare for our new factionless way of life. Starting today, everyone will begin to learn the jobs the factionless have done for as long as we can remember. We will then all do those jobs on a rotation schedule, in addition to the other duties that have traditionally been performed by the factions.
Evelyn smiles without really smiling. I don't know how she does it.
We will all contribute equally to our new city, as it should be. The factions have divided us, but now we will be united. Now and forever.
All around me, the factionless cheer. I just feel uneasy.
I don't disagree with her exactly, but the same faction members who rose up against Edward yesterday won't remain quiet after this either. Evelyn's hold on this city is not as strong as she might like. I don't want to wrestle with the crowds after Evelyn's announcement, so I weave through the hallways until I find one of the staircases in the back, the one we climbed to reach Janine's laboratory not too long ago. The steps were crowded with bodies then. Now they are clean and cool, like nothing ever happened here. As I walk past the fourth floor, I hear a yell,
and some scuffling sounds. I open the door to a cluster of people, younger than I am, and all sporting factionless armbands, gathered around a young man on the ground. Not just a young man, a Kander, dressed in black and white from head to toe. I run toward them, and when I see a tall factionless girl draw back her foot to kick again, I shout, "Hey!" No use. The kick hits the Kander boy in the side, and he groans, twisting away from it. "Hey!" I yell again, and this time the girl turns. She's much taller than I am, a good 6 inches, in fact. But I'm only angry, not afraid. "Back up," I say. "Back away from him." "He's in violation of the dress code. I'm well within my rights, and I don't take orders from faction lovers," she says, her eyes on the ink creeping over my collarbone. "Bex," the factionless boy beside her says. "That's the prior video girl." The others look impressed, but the girl just sneers. "So?" "So," I say. "I had to hurt a lot of people to get through Dauntless Initiation, and I'll do it to you too if I have to." I unzip my blue sweatshirt and toss it at the Kander boy, who looks at me from the ground, blood streaming from his eyebrow. He pushes himself up, still holding his side with one hand, and pulls the sweatshirt around his shoulders like a blanket. "There," I say. "Now he's not violating the dress code." The girl tests the situation in her mind, evaluating whether she wants to fight me or not. I can practically hear what she's thinking. I'm small, so I'm an easy target, but I'm dauntless, so I'm not that easy to beat. Maybe she knows that I've killed people, or maybe she just doesn't want to get into trouble, but she's losing her nerve. I can tell by the uncertain set of her mouth. "You better watch your back," she says. "I guarantee you that I don't need to," I say. "Now get out of here." I stay just long enough to see them scatter, then keep walking. The Kander boy calls, "Wait! Your sweatshirt!" "Keep it," I call back. I turn a corner that I think will take me to another staircase, but I end up in another blank hallway, just like the last one I was in. I think I hear footsteps behind me, and I spin around, ready to fight the factionless girl off. But there's no one there. I must be getting paranoid. I open one of the doors off the main corridor, hoping to find a window so I can reorient myself. But I find only a ransacked laboratory, beakers and test tubes scattered across each counter. Torn pieces of paper litter the floor, and I'm bending to pick one up when the lights shut off. I lunge toward the door. A hand grabs my arm and drags me to the side. Someone shoves a sack over my head while someone else pushes me against the wall. I thrash against them, struggling with the fabric covering my face, and all I can think is, "Not again, not again, not again." I twist one arm free and punch, hitting someone in a shoulder or a chin. I can't tell. "Hey," a voice says, "that hurt." "We're sorry for frightening you, Triss," another voice says. "But anonymity is integral to our operation. We mean you no harm." "Let go of me then," I say, almost growling. All the hands holding me to the wall fall away. "Who are you?" I demand. "We are the Allegiant," the voice replies. "And we are many, yet we are no one." I can't help it. I laugh. Maybe it's the shock, or the fear. My pounding heart slowing by the second, my hands shaking with relief. The voice continues. "We have heard that you are not loyal to Evelyn Johnson and her factionless lackeys." This is ridiculous. Not as ridiculous as trusting someone with your identity when you don't have to. I try to see through the fibers of whatever is over my head, but they are too dense, and it is too dark. I try to relax against the wall, but it's difficult without my vision to orient me. I crush the side of a beaker under my shoe. "No, I'm not loyal to her," I say. "Why does that matter?" "Because it means that you want to leave," the voice says. I feel a prickle of excitement. "We want to ask you for a favor, Triss Pryor.
We're going to have a meeting tomorrow night, at midnight. We want you to bring your Dauntless friends.
Okay, I say.
Let me ask you this. If I'm going to see who you are tomorrow, why is it so important to keep this thing over my head today? This seems to temporarily stump whoever I'm talking to.
A day contains many dangers, the voice says. We'll see you tomorrow, at midnight, in the place where you made your confession.
All at once, the door swings open, blowing the sack against my cheeks, and I hear running footsteps down the hallway. By the time I'm able to pull the sack from my head, the corridor is silent. I look down at it. It's a dark blue pillowcase with the words, "Faction before blood," painted on it. Whoever they are, they certainly have a flair for the dramatic. The place where you made your confession. There's only one place that could be. Kander headquarters, where I succumbed to the truth serum. When I finally make it back to the dormitory that evening, I find a note from Tobias tucked under the glass of water on my bedside table.
6.
Your brother's trial will be tomorrow morning, and it will be private. I can't go, or I'll raise suspicion. But I'll get you the verdict as soon as possible. Then, we can make some kind of plan. No matter what, this will be over soon. 4.
Chapter 8. Triss. It's 9 o'clock. They could be deciding Caleb's verdict right now, as I tie my shoes, as I straighten my sheets for the 4th time today. I put my hands through my hair. The factionless only make trials private when they feel the verdict is obvious, and Caleb was Janine's right-hand man before she was killed. I shouldn't worry about his verdict. It's already decided. All of Janine's closest associates will be executed.
Why do you care? I ask myself.
He betrayed you. He didn't try to stop your execution.
I don't care. I do care. I don't know.
Hey, Triss, Christina says, rapping her knuckles against the doorframe. Uriah lurks behind her. He still smiles all the time, but now his smiles look like they're made of water, about to drip down his face.
You had some news? She says.
I check the room again, though I already know it's empty. Everyone is at breakfast, as required by our schedules. I asked Uriah and Christina to skip a meal so I could tell them something. My stomach is already rumbling.
Yeah, I say.
They sit on the bed across from mine, and I tell them about getting cornered in one of the erudite laboratories the night before, about the pillowcase, and the allegiant, and the meeting.
I'm surprised all you did was punch one of them, Uriah says.
Well, I was outnumbered, I say, feeling defensive. It wasn't very dauntless of me to just trust them immediately. But these are strange times, and I'm not sure how dauntless I really am anyway, now that the factions are gone. I feel a strange little ache at the thought, right in the middle of my chest. Some things are hard to let go of.
So, what do you think they want? Christina says.
Just to leave the city?
It sounds that way. But I don't know, I say.
How do we know they're not Evelyn's people, trying to trick us into betraying her?
I don't know that either, I say. But it's going to be impossible to get out of the city without someone's help. And I'm not just going to stay here, learning how to drive buses and going to bed when I'm told to.
Christina gives Uriah a worried look.
Hey, I say, you don't have to come, but I need to get out of here. I need to know who Edith Pryor was, and who's waiting for us outside the fence, if anyone. I don't know why, but I need to.
I take a deep breath. I'm not sure where that swell of desperation came from, but now that I've acknowledged it, it's impossible to ignore. Like a living thing has awakened from a long sleep inside me. It writhes in my stomach and throat. I need to leave.
I need the truth.
For once, the weak smile playing over Uriah's lips is gone.
So do I, he says.
Okay, Christina says. Her dark eyes are still troubled, but she shrugs. So we go to the meeting.
Good. Can one of you tell Tobias?
I'm supposed to be keeping my distance, since we're broken up, I say.
Let's meet in the alley at 11:30.
I'll tell him. I think I'm in his group today, Uriah says. Learning about the factories. I can't wait, he smirks.
Can I tell Zeke too? Or is he not trustworthy enough?
Go ahead. Just make sure he doesn't spread it around.
I check my watch again. 9:15. Caleb's verdict has to be decided by now.
It's almost time for everyone to go learn their factionless jobs. I feel like the slightest thing could make me jump right out of my skin. My knee bounces of its own volition. Christina puts her hand on my shoulder, but she doesn't ask me about it, and I'm grateful. I don't know what I would say. Christina and I weave a complicated path through Erudite headquarters on our way to the back staircase, avoiding patrolling factionless. I pull my sleeve down over my wrist. I drew a map on my arm before I left. I know how to get to Candor headquarters from here, but I don't know the side streets that will keep us away from prying factionless eyes. Uriah waits for us just outside the door. He wears all black, but I can see a hint of abnegation gray peeking over the collar of his sweatshirt. It's strange to see my dauntless friends in abnegation colors, as if they've been with me my entire life. Sometimes, it feels that way anyway.
I told Four and Zeke, but they're going to meet us there, Uriah says.
Let's go. We run in a pack down the alley toward Monroe Street. I resist the urge to wince at each of our loud footsteps. It's more important to be quick than silent at this point, anyway. We turn onto Monroe, and I check behind us for factionless patrols. I see dark shapes moving closer to Michigan Avenue, but they disappear behind the row of buildings without stopping.
Where's Kara?
I whisper to Christina, when we're on State Street and far enough away from Erudite headquarters that it's safe to talk.
I don't know. I don't think she got an invitation, Christina says, which is really bizarre. I know she wants to...
Shh, Uriah says.
Next turn?
I use my watch light to see the words written on my arm.
Randolph Street.
We settle into a rhythm, our shoes slapping on the pavement, our breaths pulsing almost in unison. Despite the burn in my muscles, it feels good to run. My legs ache by the time we reach the bridge, but then I see the merciless mart across the marshy river, abandoned and unlit, and I smile through the pain. My pace slows when I am across the bridge, and Uriah slings an arm across my shoulders.
And now, he says, we get to walk up a million flights of stairs.
Maybe they turn the elevators on. Not a chance. He shakes his head. I bet Evelyn's monitoring all the electricity usage. It's the best way to figure out if people are meeting in secret.
I sigh. I may like to run, but I hate climbing stairs.
When we finally reach the top of the stairs, our chests heaving, it is 5 minutes to midnight. The others go ahead while I catch my breath near the elevator bank. Uriah was right. There isn't a single light on that I can see, apart from the exit signs. It is in their blue glow that I see Tobias emerge from the interrogation room up ahead. Since our date, I have spoken to him only in covert messages. I have to resist the urge to throw myself at him and brush my fingers over the curl of his lip and the crease in his cheek when he smiles and the hard line of his eyebrow and jaw. But it's 2 minutes to midnight. We don't have any time. He wraps his arms around me and holds me tight for a few seconds. His breaths tickle my ear, and I close my eyes, letting myself finally relax. He smells like wind and sweat and soap, like Tobias and like safety.
Should we go in? He says. Whoever they are, they're probably prompt.
Yes. My legs are trembling from overexertion. I can't imagine going down the stairs and running back to Erudite headquarters later.
Did you find out about Caleb?
He winces.
Maybe we should talk about that later.
That's all the answer I need.
They're going to execute him, aren't they?
I say softly. He nods and takes my hand. I don't know how to feel. I try not to feel anything.
Together, we walk into the room where Tobias and I were once interrogated under the influence of truth serum.
The place where you made your confession.
A circle of lit candles is arranged on the floor over one of the candor scales set into the tile. There is a mix of familiar and unfamiliar faces in the room. Susan and Robert stand together, talking. Peter is alone on the side of the room, his arms crossed. Uriah and Zeke are with Tori and a few other dauntless. Christina is with her mother and sister. And in a corner are two nervous-looking erudite. New outfits can't erase the divisions between us. They are ingrained. Christina beckons to me.
This is my mom, Stephanie, she says, indicating a woman with gray streaks in her dark curly hair. And my sister, Rose. Mom, Rose, this is my friend Triss, and my initiation instructor, Four.
Obviously, Stephanie says. We saw their interrogation several weeks ago, Christina.
I know that. I was just being polite.
Politeness is deception in...
Yeah, I know.
Christina rolls her eyes. Her mother and sister, I notice, look at each other, with something like wariness or anger, or both. Then her sister turns to me and says,
So, you killed Christina's boyfriend.
Her words create a cold feeling inside me, like a streak of ice divides one side of my body from the other. I want to answer, to defend myself, but I can't find the words.
Rose, Christina says, scowling at her.
At my side, Tobias straightens, his muscles tensing, ready for a fight, as always.
I just thought we would air everything out, Rose says. It wastes less time.
And you wonder why I left our faction, Christina says. Being honest doesn't mean you say whatever you want whenever you want. It means that what you choose to say is true.
A lie of omission is still a lie.
You want the truth? I'm uncomfortable and don't want to be here right now. I'll see you guys later. She takes my arm and walks Tobias and me away from her family, shaking her head the whole time.
Sorry about that. They're not really the forgiving type.
It's fine, I say. Though it's not. I thought that when I received Christina's forgiveness, the hard part of Will's death would be over. But when you kill someone you love, the hard part is never over. It just gets easier to distract yourself from what you've done. My watch reads 12 o'clock. A door across the room opens, and in walk two lean silhouettes. The first is Johanna Reyes, former spokesperson of Amity, identifiable by the scar that crosses her face and the hint of yellow peeking out from under her black jacket. The second is another woman, but I can't see her face, just that she is wearing blue. I feel a spike of terror. She looks almost like... Janine. No, I saw her die. Janine is dead. The woman comes closer. She is statuesque and blonde, like Janine. A pair of glasses dangles from her front pocket, and her hair is in a braid. An erudite from head to foot, but not Janine Matthews. Kara. Kara and Johanna are the leaders of the Allegiant?
Hello, Kara says, and all conversation stops. She smiles, but on her the expression looks compulsory, like she's just adhering to a social convention.
We aren't supposed to be here, so I'm going to keep this meeting short. Some of you, Zeke,
Tori, have been helping us for the past few days. I stare at Zeke.
Zeke has been helping Kara? I guess I forgot that he was once a Dauntless spy.
Which is probably when he proved his loyalty to Kara. He had some kind of friendship with her before she left Erudite headquarters not long ago. He looks at me, wiggles his eyebrows, and grins. Johanna continues.
Some of you are here because we want to ask for your help. All of you are here because you don't trust Evelyn Johnson to determine the fate of this city.
Kara touches her palms together in front of her.
We believe in following the guidance of the city's founders, which has been expressed in two ways, the formation of the factions and the divergent mission expressed by Edith Pryor, to send people outside the fence to help whoever is out there once we have a large divergent population. We believe that even if we have not reached that divergent population size, the situation in our city has become dire enough to send people outside the fence anyway. In accordance with the intentions of our city's founders, we have two goals. To overthrow Evelyn and the factionless so that we can reestablish the factions, and to send some of our number outside the city to see what's out there. Johanna will be heading up the former effort, and I will be heading up the latter, which is what we will mostly be focusing on tonight. She presses a loose strand of hair back into her braid. Not many of us will be able to go, because a crowd that large would draw too much attention. Evelyn won't let us leave without a fight, so I thought it would be best to recruit people who I know to be experienced with surviving danger. I glance at Tobias. We certainly are experienced with danger. Christina, Triss, Tobias, Tori, Zeke, and Peter are my selections, Kara says. You have all proven your skills to me in one way or another, and it's for that reason that I'd like to ask you to come with me outside the city. You are under no obligation to agree, of course.
Peter? I demand, without thinking. I can't imagine what Peter could have done to prove his skills to Kara.
He kept the erudite from killing you, Kara says mildly. Who do you think provided him with the technology to fake your death?
I raise my eyebrows. I'd never thought about it before. Too much happened after my failed execution for me to dwell on the details of my rescue. But of course, Kara was the only well-known defector from Erudite at that time. The only person Peter would have known to ask for help. Who else could have helped him? Who else would have known how? I don't raise another objection. I don't want to leave this city with Peter, but I'm too desperate to leave to make a fuss about it.
That's a lot of Dauntless, a girl at the side of the room says, looking skeptical. She has thick eyebrows that don't stop growing in the middle, and pale skin. When she turns her head, I see black ink right behind her ear. A Dauntless transfer to Erudite, no doubt.
True, Kara says. But what we need right now are people with the skills to get out of the city unscathed, and I think Dauntless training makes them highly qualified for that task.
I'm sorry, but I don't think I can go, Zeke says. I couldn't leave Shauna here. Not after her sister just... well, you know.
I'll go, Uriah says, his hand popping up. I'm Dauntless. I'm a good shot, and I provide much-needed eye candy.
I laugh. Kara does not seem to be amused, but she nods.
Thank you.
Kara, you'll need to get out of the city fast, the Dauntless-turned erudite girl says. Which means you should get someone to operate the trains.
Good point, Kara says. Does anyone here know how to drive a train?
Oh, I do, the girl says.
Was that not implied?
The pieces of the plan come together. Johanna suggests we take Amity trucks from the end of the railroad tracks out of the city, and she volunteers to supply them to us. Robert offers to help her. Stephanie and Rose volunteer to monitor Evelyn's movements in the hours before the escape, and to report any unusual behavior to the Amity compound by two-way radio. The Dauntless who came with Tori offer to find weapons for us.
The erudite girl prods at any weaknesses she sees, and so does Kara. And soon, they are all shored up, like we have just built a secure structure. There is only one question left. Kara asks it. When should we go? And I volunteer an answer. Tomorrow night.
Chapter 9. Tobias. The night air slips into my lungs, and I feel like it is one of my last breaths. Tomorrow I will leave this place and seek another. Uriah, Zeke, and Christina start toward the erudite headquarters, and I hold Triss's hand to keep her back. Wait, I say. Let's go somewhere. Go somewhere? But just for a little while. I tug her toward the corner of the building. At night, I can almost see what the water looked like when it filled the empty canal, dark and patterned with moonlit ripples. You're with me, remember? They're not going to arrest you. A twitch at the corner of her mouth, almost a smile. Around the corner, she leans against the wall, and I stand in front of her, the river at my back. She's wearing something dark around her eyes to make their color stand out, bright and striking. I don't know what to do. She presses her hands to her face, curling her fingers into her hair. About Caleb, I mean. You don't? She moves one hand aside to look at me. Triss. I set my hands on the wall on either side of her face and lean into them. You don't want him to die. I know you don't. The thing is, she closes her eyes, I'm so angry. I try not to think about him because when I do, I just want to... I know, God, I know. My entire life I've daydreamed about killing Marcus. Once I even decided how I would do it with a knife, so I could feel the warmth leave him, so I could be close enough to watch the light leave his eyes. Making that decision frightened me as much as his violence ever did. My parents would want me to save him, though. Her eyes open and lift to the sky. They would say it's selfish to let someone die just because they wronged you. Forgive, forgive, forgive. This isn't about what they want, Triss. Yes, it is. She presses away from the wall. It's always about what they want. Because he belongs to them more than he belongs to me. And I want to make them proud of me. It's all I want. Her pale eyes are steady on mine. Determined. I have never had parents who set good examples, parents whose expectations were worth living up to, but she did. I can see them within her, the courage and the beauty they pressed into her like a handprint. I touch her cheek, sliding my fingers into her hair. I'll get him out. What? I'll get him out of his cell. Tomorrow, before we leave. I nod. I'll do it.
Really? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure.
I...
She frowns up at me.
Thank you. You're... amazing.
Don't say that. You haven't found out about my ulterior motives yet. I grin. You see, I didn't bring you here to talk to you about Caleb, actually.
Oh?
I set my hands on her hips and push her gently back against the wall. She looks up at me, her eyes clear and eager. I lean in close enough to taste her breaths, but pull back when she leans in, teasing. She hooks her fingers in my belt loops and pulls me against her, so I have to catch myself on my forearms. She tries to kiss me, but I tilt my head to dodge her, kissing just under her ear, then along her jaw to her throat. Her skin is soft and tastes like salt, like a night run.
Do me a favor, she whispers into my ear, and never have pure motives again.
She puts her hands on me, touching all the places I am marked, down my back and over my sides. Her fingertips slip under the waistband of my jeans and hold me against her. I breathe against the side of her neck, unable to move. Finally, we kiss. And it is a relief. She sighs,
and I feel a wicked smile creep across my face. I lift her up, letting the wall bear most of her weight, and her legs drape around my waist. She laughs into another kiss, and I feel strong, but so does she. Her fingers stern around my arms. The night air slips into my lungs, and I feel like it is one of my first breaths. Chapter 10. Tobias. The broken buildings in the Dauntless Sector look like doorways to other worlds. Ahead of me, I see the pyre piercing the sky. The pulse in my fingertips marks the passing seconds. The air still feels rich in my lungs, though summer is drawing to a close. I used to run all the time and fight all the time because I cared about muscles. Now my feet have saved me too often, and I can't separate running and fighting from what they are. A way to escape danger. A way to stay alive. When I reach the building, I pace before the entrance to catch my breath. Above me, panes of glass reflect light in every direction. Somewhere up there is the chair I sat in while I was running the attack simulation, and a smear of Triss's father's blood on the wall. Somewhere up there, Triss's voice pierced the simulation I was under, and I felt her hand on my chest, drawing me back to reality. I open the door to the Fear landscape room and flip open the small black box that was in my back pocket to see the syringes inside. This is the box I have always used, padded around the needles. It is a sign of something sick inside me, or something brave. I position the needle over my throat and close my eyes as I press down on the plunger. The black box clatters to the ground, but by the time I open my eyes, it has disappeared. I stand on the roof of the Hancock building, near the zip line where the Dauntless flirt with death. The clouds are black with rain, and the wind fills my mouth when I open it to breathe. To my right, the zip line snaps, the wire cord whipping back and shattering the windows below me. My vision tightens around the roof edge, trapping it in the center of a pinhole. I can hear my own exhales despite the whistling wind. I force myself to walk to the edge. The rain pounds against my shoulders and head, dragging me toward the ground. I tip my weight forward just a little and fall, my jaw clamped around my screams, muffled and suffocated by my own fear. After I land, I don't have a second to rest before the walls close in around me, the wood slamming into my spine, and then my head, and then my legs. Claustrophobia. I pull my arms into my chest, close my eyes, and try not to panic. I think of Eric in his fear landscape, willing his terror into submission with deep breathing and logic. And Triss, conjuring weapons out of thin air to attack her worst nightmares. But I am not Eric, and I am not Triss. What am I? What do I need to overcome my fears? I know the answer. Of course I do. I need to deny them the power to control me. I need to know that I am stronger than they are. I breathe in and slam my palms against the walls to my left and right. The box creaks and then breaks, the boards crashing to the concrete floor. I stand above them in the dark. Amar, my initiation instructor, taught us that our fear landscapes were always in flux, shifting with our moods and changing with the little whispers of our nightmares. Mine was always the same, until a few weeks ago. Until I proved to myself that I could overpower my father. Until I discovered someone I was terrified to lose. I don't know what I will see next. I wait for a long time without anything changing. The room is still dark. The floor still cold and hard. My heart still beating faster than normal. I look down to check my watch and discover that it's on the wrong hand. I usually wear mine on my left, not my right. And my watch band isn't gray. It's black. Then I notice bristly hairs on my fingers that weren't there before. The calluses on my knuckles are gone. I look down and I am wearing gray slacks and a gray shirt. I am thicker around the middle and thinner through the shoulders. I lift my eyes to a mirror that now stands in front of me. The face staring back at mine is Marcus's. He winks at me, and I feel the muscles around my eye contracting as he does, though I didn't tell them to. Without warning, our arms jerk toward the glass and reach into it, closing around the neck of my reflection. But then the mirror disappears, and our hands are around our own throat, dark patches creeping into the edge of our vision. We sink to the ground, and the grip is as tight as iron. I can't think of a way out of this one. By instinct, I scream. The sound vibrates against my hands. I picture those hands as mine really are, large with slender fingers and calloused knuckles from hours at the punching bag. I imagine my reflection as water running over Marcus's skin, replacing every piece of him with a piece of me. I remake myself in my own image. I am kneeling on the concrete, gasping for air. My hands tremble, and I run my fingers over my neck, my shoulders, my arms, just to make sure. I told Triss on the train to meet Evelyn a few weeks ago that Marcus was still in my fear landscape, but that he had changed. I spent a long time thinking about it. It crowded my thoughts every night before I slept, and clamored for attention every time I woke. I was still afraid of him, I knew, but in a different way. I was no longer a child, afraid of the threat my terrifying father posed to my safety. I was a man, afraid of the threat he posed to my character, to my future, to my identity. But even that fear, I know, does not compare to the one that comes next. Even though I know it's coming, I want to open a vein and draw the serum from my body rather than see it again. A pool of light appears on the concrete in front of me. A hand, the fingers bent into claws, reaches into the light, followed by another hand, and then a head, with stringy blonde hair. The woman coughs and drags herself into the circle of light, inch by inch. I try to move toward her, to help her, but I am frozen. The woman turns her face toward the light, and I see that she is Triss. Blood spills over her lips and curls around her chin. Her bloodshot eyes find mine, and she wheezes, "Help!" She coughs red onto the floor, and I throw myself toward her, somehow knowing that if I don't get to her soon, the light will leave her eyes. Hands wrap around my arms and shoulders and chest, forming a cage of flesh and bone, but I keep straining toward her. I claw at the hands holding me, but I only end up scratching myself. I shout her name and she coughs again, this time more blood. She screams for help and I scream for her. And I don't hear anything, I don't feel anything but my heartbeat, but my own terror. She drops to the ground, tensionless, and her eyes roll back into her head. It's too late. The darkness lifts. The lights return. Graffiti covers the walls of the fear landscape room. And across from me are the mirror windows to the observation room. And in the corners are the cameras that record each session, all where they are supposed to be. My neck and back are covered in sweat. I wipe my face with the hem of my shirt and walk to the opposite door, leaving my black box with its syringe and needle behind. I don't need to relive my fears anymore. All I need to do now is try to overcome them. I know from experience that confidence alone can get a person into a forbidden place, like the cells on the third floor of Erudite headquarters. Not here, though, apparently. A factionless man stops me with the end of his gun before I reach the door, and I am nervous, choking.
"Where are you going?"
I put my hand on his gun and push it away from my arm. "Don't point that thing at me. I'm here on Evelyn's orders. I'm going to see a prisoner."
"I didn't hear about any after-hours visits today."
I drop my voice low so he feels like he's hearing a secret. That's because she didn't want it on the record.
Chuck!
Someone calls out from the stairs above us. It's Therese. She makes a waving motion as she walks down.
Let him through, he's fine.
I nod to Therese and keep moving. The debris in the hallways has been swept clean, but the broken light bulbs haven't been replaced, so I walk through stretches of darkness, like patches of bruises on my way to the right cell. When I reach the north corridor, I don't go straight to the cell, but rather to the woman who stands at the end. She is middle-aged, with eyes that droop at the edges and a mouth held in a pucker. She looks like everything exhausts her, including me. Hi, I say. My name's Tobias Eaton. I'm here to collect a prisoner, on orders from Evelyn Johnson. Her expression doesn't change when she hears my name, so for a few seconds I'm sure I'll have to knock her unconscious to get what I want. She takes a piece of crumpled paper from her pocket and flattens it against her left palm. On it is a list of prisoners' names and their corresponding room numbers. Name? She says. Caleb Pryor, 308A. You're Evelyn's son, right? Yes. She doesn't seem like the kind of person who likes the word yeah. She leads me to a blank metal door with 308A on it. I wonder what it was used for when our city didn't require so many cells. She types in the code, and the door springs open. I guess I'm supposed to pretend I don't see what you're about to do, she says. She must think I'm here to kill him. I decide to let her. Yes, I say. Do me a favor, and put in a good word for me with Evelyn. I don't want so many night shifts. The name's Drea. You got it. She gathers the paper into her fist and shoves it back into her pocket as she walks away. I keep my hand on the door handle until she reaches her post again and turns to the side so she isn't facing me. It seems like she's done this a few times before. I wonder how many people have disappeared from these cells at Evelyn's command. I walk in. Caleb Pryor sits at a metal desk, bent over a book, his hair piled on one side of his head. What do you want? He says. I hate to break this to you. I pause. I decided a few hours ago how I wanted to handle this. I want to teach Caleb a lesson, and it will involve a few lies. You know, actually, I kind of don't hate it. Your execution's been moved up a few weeks, to tonight. That gets his attention. He twists in his chair and stares at me, his eyes wild and wide, like prey faced with a predator. Is that a joke? I'm really bad at telling jokes. No, he shakes his head. No, I have a few weeks. It's not tonight. No. If you shut up, I'll give you an hour to adjust to this new information. If you don't shut up, I'll knock you out and shoot you in the alley outside before you wake up. Make your choice now. Seeing an erudite process something is like watching the inside of a watch. The gears all turning, shifting, adjusting, working together to form a particular function, which in this case is to make sense of his imminent demise. Caleb's eyes shift to the open door behind me, and he seizes the chair, turning and swinging it into my body. The legs hit me hard, which slows me down just enough to let him slip by. I follow him into the hallway, my arms burning from where the chair hit me. I am faster than he is. I slam into his back and he hits the floor face first without bracing himself. With my knee against his back, I pull his wrists together and squeeze them into a plastic loop. He groans, and when I pull him to his feet, his nose is bright with blood. Drea's eyes touch mine for just a moment, then move away. I drag him down the hallway, not the way I came, but another way, toward an emergency exit. We walk down a flight of narrow stairs where the echo of our footsteps layers over itself, dissonant and hollow. Once I'm at the bottom, I knock on the exit door. Zeke opens it, a stupid grin on his face. No trouble with the guard? No. I figured Drea would be easy to get by. She doesn't care about anything. It sounded like she'd looked the other way before.
That doesn't surprise me. Is this Pryor?
In the flesh.
Why is he bleeding?
Because he's an idiot.
Zeke offers me a black jacket with a factionless symbol stitched into the collar. I didn't know that idiocy caused people to just start spontaneously bleeding from the nose.
I wrap the jacket around Caleb's shoulders and fasten one of the buttons over his chest. He avoids my eyes. I think it's a new phenomenon, I say.
The alley's clear?
Made sure of it.
Zeke holds out his gun, handle first.
Careful, it's loaded. Now, it would be great if you would hit me so I'm more convincing when I tell the factionless you stole it from me.
You want me to hit you?
Oh, like you've never wanted to. Just do it for.
I do like to hit people. I like the explosion of power and energy, and the feeling that I am untouchable because I can hurt people. But I hate that part of myself because it is the part of me that is the most broken.
Zeke braces himself and I curl my hand into a fist.
Do it fast, you pansy cake, he says.
I decide to aim for the jaw, which is too strong to break, but will still show a good bruise. I swing, hitting him right where I mean to. Zeke groans, clutching his face with both hands. Pain shoots up my arm and I shake my hand out.
Great.
Zeke spits at the side of the building.
Well, I guess that's it.
Guess so.
I probably won't be seeing you again, will I? I mean, I know the others might come back, but you...
He trails off, but picks up the thought again a moment later.
Just seems like you'll be happy to leave it behind, that's all.
Yeah, you're probably right. I look at my shoes. You sure you won't come?
Can't. Shauna can't wheel around where you guys are going, and it's not like I'm gonna leave her, you know?
He touches his jaw, lightly, testing the skin.
Make sure Yuri doesn't drink too much, okay?
Yeah, I say.
No, I mean it,
he says, and his voice dips down the way it always does when he's being serious for once.
Promise you'll look out for him.
It's always been clear to me since I met them that Zeke and Uriah were closer than most brothers. They lost their father when they were young, and I suspect Zeke began to walk the line between parent and sibling after that. I can't imagine what it feels like for Zeke to watch him leave the city now, especially as broken by grief as Uriah is by Marlene's death. I promise, I say. I know I should leave, but I have to stay in this moment for a little while, feeling its significance. Zeke was one of the first friends I made in Dauntless after I survived initiation. Then he worked in the control room with me, watching the cameras and writing stupid programs that spelled out words on the screen, or played guessing games with numbers. He never asked me for my real name, or why a first-ranked initiate ended up in security and instruction instead of leadership. He demanded nothing from me.
Let's just hug already, he says.
Keeping one hand firm on Caleb's arm, I wrap my free arm around Zeke, and he does the same. When we break apart, I pull Caleb down the alley, and can't resist calling back,
I'll miss you. You too, sweetie.
He grins, and his teeth are white in the twilight. They are the last thing I see of him before I have to turn and set out at a trot for the train.
You're going somewhere, says Caleb between breaths. You and some others.
Yeah.
Is my sister going?
The question awakes inside me an animal rage that won't be satisfied by sharp words or insults. It will only be satisfied by smacking his ear hard with the flat of my hand. He winces and hunches his shoulders, preparing for a second strike. I wonder if that's what I looked like when my father did it to me.
She is not your sister, I say. You betrayed her. You tortured her. You took away the only family she had left. And because...
What?
Because you wanted to keep Janine's secrets? Wanted to stay in the city, safe and sound? You are a coward.
I am not a coward, Caleb says. I knew if...
Let's go back to the arrangement where you keep your mouth closed.
Fine, he says.
Where are you taking me anyway?
You can kill me just as well here, can't you? I pause. A shape moves along the sidewalk behind us, slippery in my periphery. I twist and hold up my gun, but the shape disappears into the yawn of an alley. I keep walking, pulling Caleb with me, listening for footsteps behind me.
We scatter broken glass with our shoes. I watch the dark buildings and the street signs dangling from their hinges like late clinging leaves in autumn. Then I reach the station where we'll catch the train and lead Caleb up a flight of metal steps to the platform. I see the train coming from a long way off, making its last journey through the city. Once the trains were a force of nature to me, something that continued along their paths regardless of what we did inside the city limits, something pulsing and alive and powerful. Now I have met the men and women who operate them, and some of that mystery is gone. But what they mean to me will never be gone. My first act as a Dauntless was to jump on one, and every day afterwards they were the source of my freedom. They gave me the power to move within this world when I had once felt so trapped in the abnegation sector, in the house that was a prison to me. When it comes closer, I cut the tie around Caleb's wrists with a pocket knife and keep a firm hold on his arm. "You know how to do this, right?" I say. "Get in the last car." He unbuttons the jacket and drops it on the ground. "Yeah." Starting at one end of the platform, we run together along the worn boards, keeping pace with the open door. He doesn't reach for the handle, so I push him toward it. He stumbles, then grabs it and pulls himself into the last car. I am running out of space. The platform is ending. I seize the handle and swing myself in, my muscles absorbing the pull forward. Triss stands inside the car, wearing a small, crooked smile. Her black jacket is zipped up to her throat, framing her face in darkness. She grabs my collar and pulls me in for a kiss. As she pulls away, she says, "I always loved watching you do that." I grin. "Is this what you had planned?" Caleb demands from behind me. "For her to be here when you kill me? That's... kill him?" Triss asks me, not looking at her brother. "Yeah. I let him think he was being taken to his execution," I say, loud enough that he can hear. "You know, sort of like he did to you in Erudite headquarters."
It isn't true?
His face lit by the moon is slack with shock. I notice that his shirt's buttons are in the wrong buttonholes. "No," I say. "I just saved your life, actually." He starts to say something and I interrupt him. "Might not want to thank me just yet. We're taking you with us. Outside the fence." Outside the fence. The place he once tried so hard to avoid that he turned on his own sister. It seems a more fitting punishment than death anyway. Death is so quick, so certain. Where we're going now, nothing is certain. He looks frightened, but not as frightened as I thought he would be. I feel like I understand then. The way he ranks things in his mind. His life, first. His comfort in a world of his own making, second. And somewhere after that, the lives of the people he is supposed to love. He is the sort of despicable person who has no understanding of how despicable he is. And my badgering him with insults won't change that. Nothing will. Rather than angry, I just feel heavy. Useless. I don't want to think about him anymore. I take Triss's hand and lead her to the other side of the car so we can watch the city disappear behind us. We stand side by side in the open doorway, each of us holding one of the handles. The buildings create a dark, jagged pattern on the sky. "We were followed," I say. "We'll be careful," she answers. "Where are the others?"
"In the first few cars," she says. "I thought we should be alone, or as alone as we can get."
She smiles at me. "These are our last moments in the city. Of course we should spend them alone."
"I'm really gonna miss this place," she says.
"Really," I say. "My thoughts are more like good riddance."
"There's nothing you'll miss? No good memories?"
She elbows me. "Fine," I smile. "There are a few."
"Any that don't involve me?" she says.
"That sounds self-centered, you know what I mean." "Sure, I guess," I say, shrugging. "I mean, I got to have a different life in Dauntless. A different name. I got to be 4, thanks to my initiation instructor. He gave me the name."
"Really?" She tilts her head. Why haven't I met him?
Because he's dead. He was divergent.